Where's Rachel? Are you Rachel?
No, I'm Dora Segundo. Where's Bat?
Dead, last I heard. Well, are you at least from Nebraska?
Only hussies and harlots come from Nebraska.
I understand that things are difficult because you were still grieving over your husband's death.
Ex-husband.
But there's no need to get persnickety.
My husband is not dead, but if you and Miss Schuchert aren't careful, your own days will be numbered.
What?
Bring back my husband.
Okay, so I am here with the lovely Rachel Schuchert, who is the author of Have You No Shame. Rachel, how are you doing?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm doing well. I first of all wanted to ask you if you've had an opportunity to determine if you are still on the Viacom blacklist.
I think so. I have no reason to know otherwise.
I'm wondering if you did any kind of independent investigation suggesting that this was largely a kind of peremptory threat, or whether they actually followed through with placing your name.
Yeah. I feel like I could probably go back and maybe I could, you know, if I went under assumed name, you know, I could use my husband's name.
Yeah.
I could do various, I'm sure I could get back in there. But it was, maybe all those people are gone anyway. But I don't think Sumner Redstone forgets once you're on his enemy's list.
I mean, you know, I'm wondering if there's a way you can kind of corroborate this. You know, with calling Viacom, if there's some sort of central blacklist number that you can call.
Maybe we should call them.
We should call them. I should have called them and then,
yeah,
put,
and then,
forth
and
the
then put forth
the proposition
to you. Do
you
know that you're still... Yeah. No, they were sort of irrationally angry at me, I felt.
Yeah.
But a lot of it, too, I felt was like it was anger from, like, the temp agency.
Yeah.
Because I had, like, made them look bad or something.
Yeah.
And they were like... Well, we have a reputation to uphold. We only send the very best people. And
yeah,
it's like,
yeah.
Okay.
But under the circumstances you convey in the book, it was something that just about anybody do if we're sitting in the face of nothingness.
Completely.
And boredom. Yeah.
Well, and that's what is just like so soul-crushing about temping, because they really don't have much for you to do. Like, you're just filling a chair, and they have some kind of like quota, you know, they need to have someone there. But usually they don't actually have much for you to do. Or if they do, it's just the same thing over and over and over again. You know, like, you just, you're like, data entry or like,
yeah,
you know. But it's just, I mean, and but everyone treats you like you're so stupid. And that's the other thing. Because
yeah,
you don't know where the bathroom is, so obviously, like, you can't read.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so like, it's like this very, it's a very weird place to be in if you have like any kind of sense of yourself as like an intelligent person.
Have you temped since that particular time, or have you been put off by temping because of this
incident? No, I fled to Europe after I was fired from. I fled in shame.
Yeah.
And I haven't temped again, but I've had a lot of other horrible jobs.
European temp agencies?
Well,
I'm wondering if there's any blacklist there, you know?
I don't know. Yeah. I worked when I was living in Amsterdam for a while. I was supposed to go and do this play. I'd been like hired, but then the funding fell through. So I still had this place to stay, and I couldn't even afford to like change my ticket. And also, then like right after that happened, they're like, "Well, we're not paying you for the 6 months that you're supposed to be here."
Mm-hmm.
My wallet with my ATM card and credit card was stolen. So I was just completely, I had like a little bit of money in the bank that I couldn't access because I lost my ATM card and I had no credit card. And like, it was, so I had to take this job, which was basically the only job you can get in Amsterdam as an American without any kind of work papers, which is basically being one of those like, do you like comedy people the street? Because there's this like one American like improv place called Boom Chicago. So I had to do that, and we'd have to like stand outside like the Anne Frank house and like sort of accost the people like weeping on their way out. Like, so, you know, you're sad, but you want to be happy? Come to the comedy show tonight.
So Anne Frank and me essentially got a second life perhaps here.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Anne Frank and me. Yeah, Anne Frank seems to be sort of a constant in my life.
As with Auschwitz. I mean, this seems to me one of the continuing narrative threads throughout this
book. And here
book,
we are at an Austrian coffee shop.
Obsession with Auschwitz that starts from a young age and continues on into, I suppose, today. I suppose the common arc here? Or?
I think as you get older, you start to have more real problems and you focus less on the imaginary ones. But it's certainly something that has always been like a weirdly looming thing in my life and has color perceptions. And I don't think that that's unusual, you know, even for like, I mean, it's definitely not unusual. I just really feel, I mean, I wrote about it a bit in the first chapter of the book where I like really get into that like my generation, I feel, was the first that really had sort of like Holocaust education just like completely like sort of indoctrinated
Mandatory.
Into us. Yeah, because like my parents' generation, it was so recent still that like no one talked about it, and it was really only in sort of like the 70s and 80s when like it became this kind of like industry, you know, where suddenly there were like all of these like related products, and it became this like thing that it was like you were supposed to constantly like tell kids about. And so I find that it's very common. I mean, I can't even tell you like how many people after like reading that have been like, oh my god, I could have written that chapter myself, you know, like it's a fairly common thing. And I think that the culture really sort of encourages it.
Yeah. Well, I also have to ask you about the fact that there is a particular airline that you don't name that has dashes within it. And this troublingly matches up to putting a dash into God. So I'm wondering if by referencing this airline, you are attributing some deified...
Godlike powers?
Yeah.
Well, they do. Airlines do have godlike powers. I mean, they're our equivalent of like the natural disasters in the Bible, just things that can totally ruin your life.
Yeah.
They can kill you.
Yeah.
They can leave you stranded for days and days. They can make it impossible for you to like get to like events that are incredibly important to you.
But statistically, you're okay. They can kill you, but it's so low compared to auto fatalities.
That's true, but I don't drive a car.
Yeah.
No, cabs. You're right. Cabs. I feel like, is this a weird thing that I just feel like a cab will never crash? I know that's like has no basis in reality, but I'm always like, oh, I'm
they
in a cab.
They don't report the
There's
actual
no way
cab
that they can get in an
yeah.
accident.
Well, I don't know. I've seen cabs. I saw one cab once in San Francisco get side.
Oh.
Side
yeah,
one.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
I mean, but this notion of comparing an airline to God, I mean,
it's in
do
the
you
sky.
See any corollary here, or I mean?
Well, you know, in a funny way, yeah. Sure. I mean, the dashes, I had to put those in for legal reasons.
Ah, legal reasons.
Yes. For God, too. I didn't want God to sue me.
I'm being very careful not to name the airline because I figured there was something along those lines here.
Yeah. Although I don't think they could actually sue me because it's absolutely true, everything that they did to me, you know, and I, you know, I'm sure that, like, if anything, I'll just sue them back. But, you know, I think it is an interesting idea, though, that there's a correlation between... I mean, what I find so interesting is like that. I mean, that is like a thing in like a Jewish literature that's like specifically Jewish is that there's always that dash to leave the O out because you're not supposed to write God's name because if you do, it's a holy book and then you have to. It has to be given a funeral, like a person. I actually went to a book funeral once. It was really bizarre.
Yeah,
there's like this special part of the cemetery and this big pit, and they like throw all these sort of papers in, and it's really there's this special prayers.
But it's interesting that both are bound in Holy Writ. These decisions are made because of legal reasons in one case and fear of
you know, repercussions,
yes.
divine repercussions.
Yeah, yeah, or desecration in some
sense.
In fact, both involve desecration.
Maybe the legal system has become our new God. I mean, I certainly am way more afraid of things like getting sued and stuff like that than I am of being
smote. Have you actually,
smote.
Really? Have you been involved with litigation?
No, but I have a lot of lawyers in my family.
Oh, got you.
Yeah.
Well, where are the lawyers? I didn't see the lawyers in this book so
well,
much.
The lawyers don't live in Omaha.
Ah.
There's New York
lawyers. You can't
lawyers
be a lawyer
and
in
D.C.
Omaha?
Lawyers. Oh, there are lawyers, but just, no.
Not your family lawyers,
my
they
family
have to practice
lawyers.
Outside of Nebraska in order to, are they in Nebraska or...
No, the lawyers aren't in Nebraska. None of my family in Nebraska.
There are no
lawyers
in Nebraska.
There are no lawyers in Nebraska. People just settle things, you know, like in front of a court of their peers.
Burr Hamilton like
things. Yeah, yeah, yeah. You go into the meeting house and state your case to the council.
Yeah, yeah.
And then you have to give them your cow.
Well, speaking of Nebraskans, I must point out, I mean, I'll get into the footnotes later because that's a very interesting topic, but I wanted to point out that you sort of abstained from naming a lot of famous Nebraskans. You present Nebraska as this area that doesn't have a lot of history or that has a limited sense of history. But, you know, you have, for example, Marlon Brando, Fred Astaire, and in fact, a number of talk
Marlon
show hosts.
Marlon Brando didn't really grow up in Omaha, though.
Yeah, but he's from Nebraska. Okay, but, a number of talk show hosts come from Nebraska. Johnny Carson, Dick Cavett. So,
yes.
Yeah.
I think I mentioned that Henry Fonda went to my high school.
Yes.
I think that's in there.
You do mention Monty Clift.
Yeah.
But... You know, why leave these places out? I mean, Nebraska isn't nearly as rural as one might imagine. A lot of things come from there. You know?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And I think I tried to hint at that in the book. But, I also think that, like, it's one thing to sort of be outside of Nebraska and be like, oh, all of these, you know, great things have come from there. And it's another thing to actually live there. And it's really, I mean, there's like a lot of great things that come out of any place, you know, but when you're actually living there, and it's totally like a fine place. Like I'm very, very fond of Nebraska, but it doesn't feel like you're in this like sort of cosmopolitan place where all these things are happening, even though there are like these sort of things, you know, I mean, there's like the whole Saddle Creek music thing. And I knew all those guys growing up and like, you know, I mean, things like that, all these things, but when I actually, it's funny how it's sort of taken shape in my mind, I guess, as being this sort of, a lot of that I think has to do also, not so much even with being from Nebraska, but just from like childhood, which is a pretty like narrow scope and kind of an arid place.
Well, the suggestion here that growing up in an environment of Jewish guilt is somehow tied in to this idea of Nebraska as a small place, as a place where it's you're confined in some sense.
Well, here's the thing. There are a lot of people in Nebraska, and there's a lot of famous people in Nebraska, but there's not very many Jews in Nebraska.
Yeah.
And because of that, you know, the community is extremely small and extremely tight. You know, there's like a couple thousand Jews in Omaha where I grew up.
Yeah.
But it's a very tight-knit community. Most people have been there for like several generations. Everyone is sort of related or sort of knows everything about each other. You know, it's sort of almost like when you read stories about like the shtetl where like everyone knows each other's business. And
yeah.
And it's interesting to me that like my only sort of, I had like lots of friends in high school that weren't Jewish and a lot of people. And I haven't really stayed in contact with them because I didn't have my parents to constantly be like, well, you know who's getting married and like, blah, 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 and who's just had a baby and who, you know, so it's like I feel like my roots are very much like within that community, which is sort of an outsider-y, isolated kind of thing, you know, and it's not that it's not particularly like, and it's something that what I always thought was interesting was that it sort of isolated itself by choice, you know, mm-hmm. which I think is a pretty common Jewish experience. I mean, there's especially right now, you know,
mm-hmm.
you know, now that this sort of like literal ghetto walls have fallen down, like to what extent do Jews still kind of ghettoize themselves?
Yeah, yeah.
And I felt that was extremely prevalent where I grew up. You know, like my parents had sort of like friends and colleagues that weren't Jewish, but all the inner circle, that's all, they're all Jews. And like it's a very tight community. And so in that sense, when I think about my growing up, I almost, when I read things about growing up Jewish, like, you know, someplace like in like the 50s and 60s, like I often feel that feels closer to my experience of like growing up than the experience that a lot of like my peers had like in Scarsdale or like LA where like it was no big deal, because it was definitely like a thing that set you apart that people always brought up,
mm-hmm.
you know, like people would always be like, oh right, you're Jewish or like, you know, it was like a thing all the time. And it wasn't like in all like a sort of, in no way was it like a you know, a like hateful thing. It was just like there was a clear difference.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, there's also this notion of coming to New York, which is a major Jewish metropolis as well.
Yeah.
Because, and I see this a lot of with people flocking to New York and experiencing or having their notion of Jewish identity completely changed by the particular climate here.
Yeah, mine certainly did. Yeah. I mean, I remember when I first came to college and, like, I would, you know, meet people and I'd be like, oh, your last name is Silverman? Are you Jewish? And they'd be like, yeah. And I'd be like, me too. Oh, my God. Like, well, and they would look at me like I was crazy, you know, or like I was about to try to get them to, like, go to the Chabad house. Like, you know, like, it was like, but for me, it was just so, there's no way to be prepared for that, you know, to, like, come from this place where, like, you have to always explain everything and you're always kind of, like, whatever. And even to, like, your close friends, like, you always have to, like... I mean, I remember one of my very best friends in Omaha who wasn't Jewish. Her mother would always make a big... I would always, like, come over to their house on Christmas, and her mother would always, like, get drunk and make a huge deal about it. Like, all the... Oh, Rachel's coming to our house for Christmas because she has nowhere to go. And it was like, well, I'm not, like, homeless. It's not like I don't have, like, my own family. It's just, you know, we're not really doing anything today. You know, so there's, like, this sort of... Does that make sense?
No, it definitely does.
Yeah.
There's also the notion, too, I wanted to ask you about the idea of gradients of Judaism, from hard Orthodox to looser versions.
Yeah.
And that's the thing I love about New York, actually, this idea that there are so many different stripes, and it's the striated idea.
There's definitely not that kind of freedom the way that I grew up. There's like the different denominations. There's like an Orthodox synagogue, a conservative synagogue, and a Reform synagogue. But everybody is still pretty much like in the same kind of boat. You know, like there's not like a lot of gradation like between them all. I mean, there's like a few ends, but like most people sort of fall towards the mean.
Yeah.
Whereas here, it can sort of be anything that you want to be, and you can, your Jewishness can mean as little or as much as you want it to,
mm-hmm.
which is something that I found really liberating. And I think I'm a lot more comfortable with being Jewish and sort of letting that be a part of like who I am than I ever was in Omaha, where it felt oppressive.
I wonder, though, if there are certain advantages and disadvantages to Omaha versus New York on this notion of being Jewish. Because on one hand, I mean, you know, or life in general, on one hand, you have endless possibilities. On another hand, you have limited possibilities, but each offer their own different creative scope or this different ontological scope.
Absolutely.
To a large degree. I'm wondering if you dwell upon New York in the latter part of this book, but the majority of this book involves you as a girl. In fact, that's another aspect that I found interesting, the Library of Congress classification, Nebraska Jewish Girls Biography, which I don't think I've ever seen that, which is great.
I don't know if there's another one.
Is there another one? Did you actually research this?
I don't know.
I meant to actually look that up. But I wanted to ask you about the different advantages that each possibility, each one has.
Well, in Nebraska, you know, I got to grow up with a community and a place in that community, and that's not something to be scoffed at.
Yeah.
You know, my family has really deep roots in Omaha on both sides, you know, like all of, you know, my aunts and uncles and grandparents and everybody were all there, and everyone sort of knew us and knew who we were and had, I mean, and that can be something that's really hard to give up, and a lot of people don't, you know, like a lot of people sort of go away to college and then come back, and it's great, you know, and that's the thing that they need, and it's something that I really miss in New York too, where it's easy to feel just like so incredibly lonely,
yeah,
you know, and unmoored,
yeah.
But on the other hand, in New York, you can disappear, you can sort of make decisions, you don't worry that you're going to do something and everyone's going to like harass your mother about it in the locker room at the JCC the next time she goes to the gym.
Yeah.
So, you know, in that sense, you can reinvent yourself in a way that I don't think is very possible in Omaha. And a lot of people that I know, in the, you know, like sort of friends that have stayed in the Jewish community in Omaha, it's interesting to sort of watch people just completely turn into their parents.
It's interesting that you bring up loneliness, because you write, when you were in New York, days seem very lonely when you, or sorry, days seem very long when you were lonely. Even with several hours of class each day, it was a struggle to think of enough things to occupy my time. So it almost seems as if this notion of time and speed is exclusively contingent, at least for you, upon loneliness.
I think that that's true.
Or is that a New York scenario? Is that going to this idea of multiple possibilities, of different stripes, of being able to find a niche, that you're sort of, the time is stretched because you must make a particular choice?
Yeah. Well, I think that, I don't know, I'm hardly the first person to find sort of all the options in New York paralyzing, you know, like when you
certainly.
But you know, but I mean, I think with that, it's just, you don't realize, I think, at least I didn't realize how much of my day was spent dictated by other people. And so that kind of adjustment to suddenly being sort of like self-determined and being in New York on my own and having to figure out like what my life was.
Yeah.
You know, that was there's kind of like an inherent loneliness in that, when like you're not sort of accountable to anybody else and you sort of have to make your own way and figure out things to do. I remember right after I graduated from college just being like, it's like, I don't know what I'm supposed to, you know, do now. Like, how do I mean, like, forget about having any kind of, like, career goals I suddenly did achieve. I was like, I don't know what I'm supposed to do today. Mm-hmm. And I remember running into, like, an old teacher of mine, and I was trying to hail a cab. I was sort of doing this kind of half-assed internship that was only, you know, and I was picking up some soup from the dry cleaners and taking it back to someone else. And she was like, do you want to share the cab with me? Because we're going the same direction. And I was like, yeah. And she's like, how are you doing? And I just sort of started to cry, like with this like suit in my lap. And was like, I just don't even know like how to begin. Like, I just feel like these hours and I don't know how to fill them. And I she was like, well, you just have to start telling people that you'll do things and then do them. Like right now you told them that you would pick up the suit and you're taking it to the dry cleaners, and then somebody else will ask you, you'll tell someone else that you'll take care of this for them and then do that, and eventually those add up into your life.
Yeah.
Which is really kind of true.
Yeah. I guess I'm struck by this because one would expect you to describe the idea of stretching out time being in Nebraska, but instead you apply this to New York. And that's why I bring this up. That's why I think it's not just an obvious observation.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes. Well, I think it is a bit of a cliche that New York, you're always busy in New York and you always have, I mean, obviously there's like a bunch of options, but that doesn't mean you always have something to do. You know, it doesn't mean any of the options are your option. And I've definitely felt that way in New York. Whereas in Nebraska, you know, there was always something I was supposed to do, you know, with somebody or for somebody. And I think, but I think a lot of it is going from that place where you are part of the fabric of this kind of community to going a place where you are your own fabric, you know, and like you have to sort of eventually make your own community, you know. And eventually I think you do, but, you know, that experience of like moving to New York and having just no sense of what made me anymore and like where I could sort of hook in and be a part of something.
There is one thing I wanted to ask you about. There's one section in which, well, there's a number of sections that you get considerably scatological in, but the section I'm thinking involves your nether regions, and I won't reveal exactly what it is unless you want to, but...
It's a spoiler.
Yeah, a spoiler. But I did want to ask you how you approached writing that. There are a number of question marks that are littered right around the revelation of what
just had no words.
I mean, well, I asked because I'm wondering if you had to approach that section multiple times in order to get it right, or whether it was a matter of just directly spelling it out.
That actually is the section I wrote the fastest, and like, I hadn't even planned to write that story, and then I like woke up at like, you know, 1 a.m. or something from a sleep, and I was like, oh, write that story. And I just kind of sat down at my computer and wrote until 7 a.m., and it came out like, it was really the only time working on the book that I had like just that immediate sort of dictation where it's just like going straight from your head to your page. I mean, usually for me, like, right, it's like extracting teeth. Writing is like so, you know, it's not, I'm not an easy
you're
writer.
Speaking of cliches.
Yeah, I know. But, you know, it's just, it's like, it's difficult for me. It's not like, I don't always get into the flow right away. I mean, you have to a little bit, obviously, or you'll never do anything. But that was like, writing that section actually, and it's really like very unchanged too since like the very first draft that I wrote that, you know, in like that one run that night. So, but I think that it's a little bit different than the rest of the book because it's one section that doesn't sort of go back and forth in time. It doesn't have a lot of sort of like commentary on what's happening. It's just like a very sort of straightforward, like, this is what happened. And I think it's because I literally had like, I felt like the story kind of spoke for itself and I didn't have anything to add to it other than the event.
Well, I also find it interesting that you place this parental advisory, but you urge those who are concerned about explicit material to go to this particular chapter, which to my mind is more explicit than...
Oh, I don't, though. I tell them to go ahead to the chapter that's about the acting, I think.
No, but that's at the tail end.
Oh, right.
Yeah, yeah. What I'm talking about here, this nether regions thing. I found that to be kind of interesting because this arguably is more explicit than...
Well, that was kind of a little joke, I think, towards all the people in Omaha I knew would read it and would read things about, like, me, you know, being sexual in high school. And then, again, would have to, like, you know, like, corner my mother and with, like, their mouth full of, like, brownie at the synagogue and be like, so what do you think about Rachel writing about penises, you know? Yeah. And so that was kind of a little dig at that kind of thing. You know, I feel like, I don't know if this happens as much to guys, but I feel like every girl that I know that has sort of, I mean, I don't think of myself as a particularly sexual writer, but I don't shy away from sort of, you know, things that have to do with my body or that kind of aspect of things. And I think that it's a really sort of sexist label that gets affixed to women who write about sex as opposed to men who write about sex who are never sex writers, who are never sort of like, you know, pigeonholed into being like...
I guess it's the logical extension of the slut versus stud nonsense.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So I don't know if... I don't know if, like, men get the same thing, but, you know, girls aren't supposed to talk about things like that, I think. Especially sort of... And I everybody, almost every woman that I know has sort of fielded that question. If they've written about any of this thing, there's always... They've told me some story about, like, how someone, like, talked to them in an interview about it. So what do your parents think about, like, what you're writing about? You know, which I think is, like, such an unfair question because, like, why would you ever ask somebody that? Like, you know, like, why... Why should you limit your experience to, like, what your mom and dad, who are, if they're decent parents, are going to be proud of you anyway, you know, like, but it's just very interesting to me that women are supposed to think about how they're perceived by the rest of the world and what other people will think of them, and, you know, rather than just be judged on the merits of the work itself.
Do you care about this question, about how you were perceived by putting all of this stuff out there? I mean, the title is Have You No Shame?
Yeah, which is also kind of, I think, like, a little bit of a joke on that concept. I don't care personally. And I mean, I just want. I mean, if people are going to judge me unfavorably, if they don't like my writing, that's one thing, but I don't want to be judged on the content of it, as that somehow, maligns my character or something. Like, if you don't like what I write about, if you don't like my writing, that's one thing, if it somehow means that, I'm, some kind of, mm-hmm. slutty, do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
That's not something I'm interested in. I'm not interested in that opinion. Does that make sense?
No, it does, but there are limits you are imposing because, for example, you don't write about your husband. There are a number of things that we were talking about before we set up the mics that I didn't know about until you told me that aren't in there. So are there any limits to what you will write about?
Yeah.
What ground rules do you set?
I'm careful about writing about my husband, and I'm starting to a little bit more, and in this next book that's going to be a follow-up, he's actually more of a character. I mean, part of why he's not in the book is because he wasn't in my life for most of that book, but I'm careful about that because there are certainly aspects of our relationship. It's not so much for me, but him. He's a little bit more circumspect about things than I am, and I want to respect that. He's a person that I love. And I tried to sort of take care of how I portrayed my parents. I mean, I know there's that quote about how, writing about someone is inherently an act of violence. And I think that that's true to some extent. But I also think that you can try to be very mindful of what you're doing and try to figure out, what's necessary to, get something across and what is just sort of extraneous and hurtful.
But is there too much? I mean, I think I'm concerned with this question in light of the hysteria going on about Emily Gould's piece, which is appearing this Sunday.
Yeah.
And it hasn't even hit the newsstands, and already there are thousands of comments on this piece that is essentially TMI, depending upon who you talk to. But it's also this brazen essay of Miss Gould essentially revealing everything about herself, that there is no private umbrella for this. It's just completely spilling out. Do you have any sort of sense of keeping things private, or how do you negotiate this line?
I definitely have a sense of, but I think the things that I find very private are things that other people don't necessarily find private, and the things that I'm totally willing to tell people are, and vice versa.
Yeah.
I think my sense of privacy is a little bit skewed. And I think, but I also think that our sort of concept of privacy and what's private has really changed over the past several years, just the huge explosion in sort of not only in memoir, but in sort of confessional stuff on the internet and using sort of people turning their personal lives into a brand, but there are certainly stories I'm not interested in telling people.
I guess the question is more along these lines of how do you negotiate this balance between the public and the private. I agree with you that, that one should have some element of privacy, but if you are putting yourself on the line for personal writing and you have this environment in which you're expected to essentially suffuse and spew all this information about yourself, that this is essentially what the environment craves, well, how do you deal with that? Is it a matter of just being candid about your nether regions?
I think it's a matter of being, you just sort of play it by ear, I mean, for me, it's a matter of being candid about. I definitely have that sort of writerly, if it's a good enough story, it's sort of irresistible to me to tell it, whether it's a very personal thing or not. It's compulsive almost.
Yeah.
Because I think when I'm writing about myself, the other thing that maybe answers this question is that I don't exactly think of the person I'm writing about as me. Which is a little bit schizophrenic, but you need to sort of split yourself off from yourself in order to have a writerly perspective on things and, be able to sort of look back and shape events into a way that means something and is organized, but also just to be able to my inner life is it's almost like I'm writing about a character and she has my name and she has all the details of my biography, but she's a little bit different than me. And I think that that's really kind of the key to doing this kind of writing, that you need to sort of, because you also need to make yourself a little bit more extreme or a little more interesting than you really are too, otherwise why would anyone want to read what you're writing? So I think that there is that kind of fractured sense of self, which is maybe not the healthiest in the long run, but
Well, perhaps it's more healthy, one might argue. I guess it depends on the person to have some persona or some separation of who you really are. I mean, there are character composites in this. I mean, to what degree do you prevaricate? To what degree do you fabricate? And how truthful really is this, would you say?
How truthful is the book?
Yeah.
It's pretty truthful. I mean, there's certainly a lot of details, especially of sort of, you know, people who have been changed or amalgamated. But there's really not too much in it that didn't happen. I mean, obviously memory is subjective. And something that happened may mean something to you. It means something very different 10 years later than it did when it was happening. But there's nothing really that's like too made up. You know, like a few characters in it that are sort of secondary are sort of like the ideas of characters, you know, but only to a very minor degree.
Yeah.
Most all of it is pretty real.
Yeah.
But you know, I it was very important to me. I really didn't want people to be able to like read it and be like, oh, that's me. You know, like I wanted to sort of disguise details of. I mean, I didn't want some guy I like slept with 15 years ago to like come out of the woodwork and be like, blah, blah, blah. Well, not 15. I didn't sleep with anyone 15 years ago, but 10 years ago.
I was about to say, I read this book. Now this is something that was obviously private. Wow.
You know, so I wanted to like, you know, fudge some of those kind of things a little bit too. And that actually helps in that sort of like fractured self too, that when you've sort of changed enough like minor details, you can sort of get to a place where it's not exactly fiction, but like, you're kind of putting yourself in a situation that's slightly different than the actual thing, and it makes it a little bit easier, I think, to reveal or to just be like objective about what you're writing about.
I wonder if it's style that helps you create this fracturing of the self. I mean, we alluded to the footnotes very briefly earlier, but I'm wondering if that separation or the annotation of text helps you to keep relatively distanced enough so that you can create this persona on
absolutely
page.
Absolutely. And also the fact that I sometimes sort of play with like very elevated language, you know, like very sort of like arch elevated prose, that's part of that too, I think. You know, that if you write, even if it's something horrible, if you write about it in sort of an elevated way, like it has this you know, this kind of separation, and you can set yourself apart from it also. And I also like the tension of that, like I find a lot of humor in that, you know. So yeah, that's a really good point. I think that's definitely one of my tricks.
Were there any other sets of footnotes that you had aside from the?
Yes, actually, when I first my very very first draft, I had like all kinds of footnotes.
They're
mostly
it.
Just things that like I couldn't that I wanted to say and like you know didn't fit in. And then I was like, you know, I don't really need a lot of these like little extra ones that are just, I can get, if they're really good jokes or really like interesting, I'll just put them into the text. And if they're not, then I'll just,
well, what were
I'll
some of these sets?
They weren't actually sets. They were just like, you know, just sort of like random footnotes. The two sets, the Gentile one and the Nebraska one, those were always in there and they were always as they were. And my editor liked them a lot and actually wanted me to add more. So some of the footnotes that weren't got sort of absorbed into those. But they were most of them weren't very good. Most of them were just like sort of like really like obnoxious little asides and things that I was like, I think the book is stronger without them.
Well, there's also the footnotes within the bar mitzvah speech, which seem to me.
Those are special.
Well, those are special because they carry the undeniable influence of this David Foster Wallace story, Tristan, Isol, Sissy, Nartu, Echo. I have to read off a paper because I can never quite remember that. I'm wondering if that served as influence because it has the same.
No, I never read that story.
Look back into the present, you know, references to Mr. Belvedere and the like that he has. I'm surprised that you have it. It's almost exactly the same.
Oh, really? No, I've never read that
it's,
story.
Yeah, it's in Brief Interviews with Hideous Men.
I'll tell you what influenced it the most. It's not very highbrow at all. It was this book that my dad had that I remember reading just over and over again when I was about 6 years old called Motel of the Mysteries, which was by David McCauley, you know, the one that did The Way Things Work.
Yeah.
And it was this illustrated book, and it was set in the future, and it was this team of archaeologists that were excavating like a motel room, a contemporary motel room, but, you know, 3,000 years. So they were like finding all of these, you know, like the toilet seat and deciding that was some kind of like ceremonial headdress along with the like plug in the bathtub that she was like wearing, like photograph, like around, you know, and that it must have been some kind of burial chamber, because like the conceit, I guess, was that there'd been like some, I can't remember, it was like a volcanic eruption or some kind of natural disaster, so all this stuff had been buried like intact.
Yeah.
So they found, you know, they found like the skeleton like laid out on the motel bed, like holding like a remote control still, and like, you know, very like Pompeii kind of. But that was like what I thought of the most when I wrote that story.
There's also Will Self's The Book of Dave as well.
Oh.
Have you heard of this?
I've heard of it. I've never read it.
It's essentially
also.
This cab driver, you know, is scribbling his life story. Mm-hmm. And years into the future, the remnants of humanity in this apocalyptic London have taken this and have formed a pidgin language based off of this diary. It's a very inventive book.
Oh, wow, yeah. Yeah, no, that's definitely like, it's a conceit that has always fascinated me. I mean, I love museums. I love like ancient history museums, and I always think it's hilarious, you know, the sort of like conclusions people come to about like, wow, you know, and it just, it was always like a very fertile ground, obviously.
But Mr. Wallace, you haven't read him?
I haven't read that story.
Is he an influence? I'm curious.
I
mean, the footnotes have the same kind of quality.
Yeah, I know he writes footnotes. I really haven't read any David Foster Wallace. I'm terrible about, like, I don't...
Well, then we're going to stop this conversation right now, because clearly you're beneath me.
You're not well read enough.
This is a highbrow program.
But I know that, you know, I know that he writes with footnotes and things. And I like, I mean, I think I like to write, because I've always read a lot of like nonfiction, you know, like sort of like history and stuff, and I've always found the footnotes really interesting. And
it's informed more by nonfiction then.
Yeah.
That makes sense.
Yeah, it's definitely informed more by reading, you know, sort of like historical things about like various periods.
Well, this makes sense in light of your Auschwitz fixation and Shoah fixation.
No, I'm definitely a history buff. I think that's probably mostly what I read. I mean, I read other things, but that's. It comes more from that.
Was the letter to Newt Gingrich, the sense I got with that was that this was a elevated or expanded version of what you may have originally sent to the man?
I never wrote anything to Newt Gingrich.
Okay.
That's not true. That's an untruth.
Yes.
That was made up.
We're getting those packs of lies.
Although I do remember thinking that a lot throughout
that whole Did you ever write letters to congressmen or anything?
No, I wrote a letter to Princess Anne when I was in first grade, and her secretary wrote back. I still have the letter.
Did you get a picture?
I think she did send like a little picture. Yeah.
I used to have a picture of Reagan when I wrote as a kid. I recall burning it in effigy even when I was that young.
Yeah, Reagan was.
Yeah, I was a rabble rouser even then. So.
I remember I kept the envelope too because it had like a British stamp, and I was very excited by that. And I also thought it was amazing that she had a male secretary. I had never known such a thing was possible.
Mm-hmm. Do you write letters at all, or is it all email now?
I used to write letters. Mostly now it's email. It's hard to find people who write letters back. I don't like to write them in a vacuum.
Yeah. Well, it's actually good because a lot of older people still write letters, and so I do write letters to some folks. Like
I write handwritten thank you notes for everything and send them in the mail.
That's good. That's good. I wanted to ask you. I've got lots. Oh yeah, I actually to deal with style a little bit. You wrote some sections in all caps. I mean, and we're talking here about this notion of online discourse versus print discourse.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, all caps looks different on a screen versus the printed page, and I'm wondering if this was a consideration as you were writing some of these streaming capitals.
I think a little bit where that comes from is that, you know, I'm a playwright also, and I often tend to write lines in all caps just because I feel like it's immediately evocative of like what it's trying to get across. You know, like I want to
write for soap operas then, because that's what they do there.
Yeah, I know. I love soap operas. Well, I've got that whole soap opera show.
I know.
Yeah, so I think that came out of that a little bit, and I often like feel that way. You know, like a certain emotion. I'm just like, oh, this is all in caps. It's all. I mean, I sort of see words in my head when I'm thinking them, and like sometimes they just look like they're all in capital letters.
There's also a lot of different typefaces. How did you establish this? Did you specify the typefaces, or was this the layout person?
No, that was the layout person, mostly. Yeah. I mean, I think they wanted to, like, make certain bits look different from others, and that was the layout person more than me. I would have preferred to have all the same diamonds.
You capitulated all control in terms of the look of the text, because I mean this
bit.
Is a very stylistic
yeah.
book.
I mean, not completely, obviously, like yeah. you know, I approved it all ultimately, but I mean I think it works in a couple of places, and I mean they wanted things to look I mean, there's a lot of playing with sort of different kinds of formats in the book, and I think, you know, we wanted to make those clear, like, when we were switching back and forth, you know, like, the ones that are sort of like recipes, and then the ones that's sort of like a play, and then the part that's like, you know, I'm switching back and forth from, like, an interview. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I wanted that to be clear, and I think that was the idea behind it.
The notion of taxonomies are throughout this book, too, grouping types of people, like the five different types of male
yeah.
teenage life and the like. I'm wondering if this came from the plunging into history books that you were referring to earlier.
Yeah, I think so, probably. I mean, I think it's interesting to hear this all coming, because I feel like, you know, you sort of absorb these things, like, just as you live your life, you
yeah.
know, these sort of things, and it's really interesting to hear someone else observe them back to you. I think that that's true, but I also think, I don't know, I mean, I think that that kind of... I find that kind of taxonomy stuff, like, also very funny.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, going back to this elevated language, I know you describe your grandfather's speech as punctuated with appreciative suckling. That's a new one on me. There are a few descriptions along those lines throughout the book, and yet there's also a very straight dialogue base, which is no surprise because you do theater. But I wanted to ask you about the notion of a phrase like that. When is it necessary for you? When... do you need that additional detail to kind of throw a little skewered perspective on the events that are unfolding?
Well, I think when I feel that there's it's something that's so specific that it needs like a special kind of turn of phrase to like really evoke what I'm trying to say, you know, and also I find that juxtaposition very funny. I mean, it's very funny to me, like, you know, using some kind of sort of elevated description for, you know, my grandfather, like, smacking his lips while he's eating,
yeah.
you know?
Yeah.
And, but they, those definitely come sort of organically to me, you know? I don't know if it's quite so conscious as, like, I need to have that there as it is. Like, that's how I thought of it.
But in revision, perhaps you are hacking away and getting rid of things that are unnecessary, and then some things that you look at and you say, oh, this is a phrase that I can't kill because it needs to be there. So I don't know if it's entirely subconscious.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, certainly I'm sure I paired things out that felt unnecessary, you know. But I definitely feel that that's really part of my voice, and I wanted to keep it, you know, in there.
Now, Fred Astaire and Jason Priestley are rather odd choices to teach to Soviet children. And I have to ask why television stars...
Oh,
the two men you like the best. So it was really based off of that, because they're both from television. They're not from films or
Fred
anything.
Fred Astaire?
Well, there is Fred Astaire. That's true.
Yes. Well, Jason Priestley and...
No, it was Fred Savage, I thought.
Oh, Fred Savage.
Fred Savage and
yeah,
Jason
Priestley and Fred Savage were the two guys on TV that I had big crushes on as a child. I had a picture of Fred Savage in my locker that I cut out from the newspaper. I remember he was holding a candy box, like a Valentine's heart box, and I would pretend that he was holding it for me.
Yeah.
And then when I got a little older, I thought Jason Priestley was the handsomest man I had ever seen. I mean, when I say a little older, I mean like 10.
Yeah.
But I had a big poster of him in my room too.
Who was the first crush you had?
Gene Kelly.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
And he's not referenced in the book?
No. That's private.
Not anymore. It's public now. No, I mean, this is an interesting distinction. I are you slightly ashamed of these crushes? Or?
No, I'm not ashamed. But that doesn't, you know, there's a difference between being ashamed of something and, you know, just having something sort of close to your heart.
Wow. Well, I mean, I'm curious, how much does a crush linger over the course of one's life like this? I mean, you can be safe with Jason Priestley and Fred Savage, but not so much.
I don't
much.
Have crushes on them anymore.
But you still have a crush on Gene Kelly.
Yes, and he's dead.
He's dead.
He's dead.
The dead people are the ones to really lust after the best.
Yeah, yeah. I think that that's true.
Because there's no way you can possibly consummate it.
I also loved Paul Newman as a child.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What are you going to do when he dies?
I'll be sad. I'll mourn like a widow.
I want to ask you about this book coming out as a paperback original. How do you feel about this? We're seeing a lot of younger writers. Ed Parks' Personal Days also comes to mind, in which paperback original really is the thing now.
I think it's a publishing industry thing. You know, I think that they're less willing to, like, bring out a hardback of a first-time writer, you know, and,
yeah.
and they sort of tell you, they're like, well, you'll sell more books if it just immediately comes out in paperback, because, I mean, it's all publishing industry thing, I think.
Yeah.
I think it's a little bit self-defeating, because I feel that, yeah, like, you bring something out in a paperback, but, you know, this sort of, I think that in a lot of ways, like, the sort of, like, mainstream press hasn't caught up to the idea that a lot of new great writers are coming out in paperback, and so don't necessarily pay attention to paperback books the way they should,
mm-hmm.
and, like, as far as, like, critical response and press. But, I mean, I think it's really, like, I think a rationale of, you know, they're all trying to tighten their belts, because they're all just terrified of the internet still,
yeah.
I think. And,
yeah. Well, also, I wanted to ask you about the Anorexics Cookbook, which is disturbingly similar in name to the Anarchist's Cookbook.
Yes, that was on purpose.
Yeah. Did you read the Anarchist Cookbook?
I read the Anarchist Cookbook.
Did you use any of the recipes in there?
No, the recipes are all original. I didn't get them from the Food Network. They're mine.
Well, okay.
Yeah.
I mean, how much of a crossover was there with this?
With the Anarchist Cookbook?
Anarchists and Anorexics, yeah. I mean, it hasn't been published yet.
Yeah. It was just sort of a pun, I think.
I'm looking forward to you going on Rachel Ray with this wonderful book.
I know, yeah. It's an unpublished cookbook. You know, it's funny, that was actually excerpted on Nerve, parts of that, and it got some good responses. Then some people were like, this is so unhealthy, the pro-Anna movement, you know, like that whole thing. It's always strange when you stir up some kind of minor controversy without even being aware of it.
Yeah.
I mean, my idea was that it had been an idea that I had for a long time. It was like, what if there was a cookbook just of all these things? And it was just like in my head, it was something I thought was funny. Like, and then you'd have these sort of like photos of like these really bony hands, mm-hmm. like reaching for things. And, it was just something I wanted to show, the kind of absurdity of anorexic thinking and like what you sort of feed yourself and how just odd and,
yeah.
you know, kind of shocking it is a little bit, you know, although it's not really ever my goal to shock as much as it is to amuse.
Yeah. How much of this book was unfurled in short pieces elsewhere? It was never really clarified. In fact, I was curious about this. I was searching the internet trying to see if I could find some
the
of these things.
The only thing that was sort of unfurled, there was that story about like the sort of Jewish youth group.
Yeah.
That was a small bit of that was on Nerve. I mean, it started out as a short piece that was published on Nerve, and then I expanded it. But that was everything else was new.
I'm wondering how much these served as tryout pieces to see how an audience would accept this and how much this informed the creation of the larger book.
Mm-hmm. I was doing readings and things, and sometimes I would like debut a little bit and sort of read it out loud and see how it worked and,
mm-hmm.
you know, see what the response was and tweak what needed to be tweaked. I mean, I kind of used the audience as guinea pigs, I guess, in the editorial process.
Interesting. So reading aloud to an audience was a better litmus test than having people read it online in some capacity, or?
Yeah. And nobody did read any of this stuff online, so except for that one little piece of
Except
that
for Gene
story.
Kelly.
Except for Gene Kelly. Yes, in heaven.
Yes. Well, Rachel, it was a pleasure chatting with you. Thank you so
you
much.
You too. Thanks, you.
My sister, tell me what the trouble is. I'll try to listen good and give the best advice that I can give. So.